Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
This is Jessica, and you're listening to the Friendly Atheist Podcast. I am joined today by Cameron Esposito. I'm so excited to have you here and shocked that you came on my weird, dumb show.
Why do you say that? Tell me.
Oh, my goodness. Because I record it in my kitchen in the suburbs of Chicago with my friend Heaven, and it's very surprising to be in the Earwolf Studios. I feel like a real podcaster.
You look like a real podcaster. Oh my God, you got the headphones on.
Yeah.
Is that a
it's a sound,
wave. Signature?
Yeah. Yes.
What is that a sound wave of?
It is. It's my necklace. My husband gave it to me on my wedding day. It says "I love you, Jessica." It's like his voice saying it. He's an extremely good gift giver.
Were you already podcasting at the time?
Yes, I was.
Wow, that is. I love this.
Yes,
this is very good.
He's a very good gift giver. It's very intimidating for me because I'm notoriously not. So, I'm so thrilled to have you here. First of all, because I am a graduate of FemCom, which is the Women's Comedy Training Center that you kicked off in Chicago.
Yes.
Which is awesome. Kelsey Huff was my teacher. I learned a lot, made a ton of great friends. Can we kind of dig into a little bit why you started FemCom and what it means to be a woman in comedy and why you wanted to make a space for women in comedy specifically?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm trying to get I wish I had the exact year in my brain, but there's a Christopher Hitchens article. You could look it up.
The Women Aren't Funny article?
The Women Aren't Funny article. And it's from like still sort of early internet days in terms of things going viral. I'm just going to vaguely timestamp it. Like maybe it's from 2007 or 2008.
Yeah.
But anyway, his premise is that women aren't funny and here's why. And after that article happened, it seemed as if every news outlet wanted to write a response specifically to him, to that question and their own take on why women aren't funny. And I had been doing stand-up. I started doing improv professionally the day after I graduated from college. But I had just started doing stand-up. I'm like 5 minutes into my career. I start getting media inquiries, which felt like so exciting. But they were all on this topic.
Uh-huh.
And because there were very few women at the time doing stand-up in Chicago, really in my class, there was one other woman doing the sort of type of stand-up that I was doing, Beth Stelling. There was Jenna Friedman was doing some more surreal stuff, and she'd written like an off-Broadway show, and the Putterbaugh sisters were doing a group act, and Lauren Lapkus was there as a sketch comic, but there were very few women doing stand-up. So I was fielding questions on behalf of women in comedy, first of all. I'd been doing stand-up for like 1 year. You know, it's like there are people who maybe could speak on this more intelligently at the time, but also, you know, it was the only attention I was getting. And that's fair. You know, you shouldn't necessarily be, like, getting a ton of media attention a year in. But then I gave some interviews, and the men that were operating in the scene were upset. I mean, I just saw on the internet that, like, Stephen King, today, the day we're recording this, is talking about how he doesn't privilege diversity in his Academy Award voting. And
which is such a shock that the Academy Awards are all white men being nominated this year. I can't believe it.
Right. And also, it's such an unintelligent reading of what people are asking for in terms of diversity. Nobody is asking that people who are bad at their jobs get to be paid and advanced simply because of their sex, gender, or skin color.
Right.
Nobody is asking for that.
Right.
It is simply that maybe if you are somebody who privileges a certain type of voice, that you, like, think about the fact that maybe other people have something to offer.
Right.
Literally just giving a second glance elsewhere. Mm-hmm. It's not even hard to do. Yep. You don't lose anything.
Yep.
But the men in the stand-up scene...
But they don't see it that way, do they? They see every woman, every person of color, every queer person who gets a job is, kicking a man out of the director's chair, I feel like.
Well, I don't think that's... I don't even fault dudes, like straight cis white dudes for that. I don't fault them for that. Here's why. If you have only been given your viewpoint to look at, like the lens.
Right.
Is this person's lens.
Right.
So if you've always seen media that you can relate to in a one-to-one relationship, if you've seen history that you can relate to in a one-to-one relationship, moving outside of that would probably feel like a real ask.
Yeah.
But like for us, for you or I, like I've always been approaching media from like this is a perspective that I'm inhabiting for the duration of this film or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think that's where what the argument needs to be. Like, yes, this is maybe something that you relate to less. Mm-hmm. Does that mean it's less good?
Mm-hmm. Which is wild because the idea of movies and a lot of media is escapism, is to sort of step outside of your own story. And yet, if men are asked to do that even a little bit outside their gender or their race, they're like, it's not for me. It's not about me. I don't care.
Value isn't whether or not something reflects your lived experience.
Exactly. Yes.
So anyway, that's all a bit of a long way of saying that after this series of interviews and then some backlash, I just decided to, I started an experiment. That's what FemCom was. It was an experiment. I went to Mark Geary, who is a producer who created a show called The Lincoln Lodge in Chicago. Mm-hmm. And I asked him if he would help me in renting some space and, putting tickets online to create a class for women. And it was going to run for 8 weeks and it would help women to write their first 5 minutes of stand-up.
Mm-hmm.
Because my hypothesis was that women are not cultured to take space and to speak in our own voice, and that the biggest barrier to entry for comedy is that it is uncomfortable to sit there at the very beginning and be alone, the only person like you in the room, and not even know how to write jokes in your own voice because you don't know how to speak in the eye, because women aren't taught to speak in the eye.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was just like, hey, I wonder if we just helped folks write their first 5 minutes, if that would change overall participation in the stand-up scene by women. And I actually believe that this worked.
I would concur.
Because I trained, I think, over 100 women. Kelsey also, and then Alex Kuman, who teaches the class now, I think, still, have trained hundreds more. Mm-hmm. But I also started an open mic that still runs at Cole's Bar around the same time. That's also in Chicago.
Which open mic?
It's called Cole's.
Oh.
Yeah. It's a Wednesday night open mic, and it would be about half women because people would come from the class.
Mm-hmm.
And then over time, people that weren't in the class felt more comfortable there because there were just more women there.
Mm-hmm.
And it sort of created this movement within the scene, which I think has sort of never totally shifted back, where there are a lot more women and queer folks.
Yeah.
And I don't say this to congratulate myself, although I'm very proud of this, but more so just to be like, I think this is a path. We also see people doing this in political organizing right now.
Yep.
You know, we see people training women to get on the ballot and that is having a real effect.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that this is a process that, that really works.
Yeah. It was so life altering for me because I've always been a writer and I've always been like the funny friend of my group. And actually speaking of good gifts, my husband got me the first set for Christmas.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. Cause it was something I'd always talked about doing and like, obviously was never going to do anything about that. It was much easier just to talk about how funny I would be. And then this class, like we all got so close, and then for probably 2 years after, we would just go as a pack to various open mics and almost always the only women, almost always the only, like there was a couple of people of color, almost always the only ones there. And it just meant a lot. And I'm you know, still in touch with most of them. One of them ran for Congress, and I, like, wrote on her campaign. It was...
Wow, really? Yeah. That is awesome!
Yes, it was it was just such a, like, big shift in the direction my life went.
Yes.
And I'm grateful for it.
Oh, that's great to hear.
So yeah, that was... Yeah, I thank you for that. It was really meaningful, and to carve out that space for women is... something that I think is incredibly important and we need to do more frequently.
You know, the other thing that I really learned in that class, in teaching that class, is that not everybody who took it had the goal of becoming a professional comic.
Mm-hmm.
And also not everybody did become a professional comic. Right. Some did.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's also a standard that we hold for women only.
Yes.
Like, I know so many men that I started with who were like, maybe they were bad at stand-up.
Mm-hmm.
They got invited to, you know, enter the, like, social world of the comedy scene, mm-hmm. you know. And even if people thought they were, like, a shitty stand-up, they would laugh about the fact that they were a shitty stand-up.
Yeah.
And then those people still go do mics today. And it's, mm-hmm. like, the expectation that we also will only do things that we are going to be the best at
yeah.
is also something that I hope that that class... still provides in Chicago, which is just like, it's actually okay to dabble in something. It's also okay to pursue something and then use the skills that you learn there elsewhere.
Yes. Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And I don't really do stand that much anymore. The podcast has kind of taken that
yeah.
creative energy. And I live in Aurora now, no brag. but yeah, it's, I think, something that really shaped kind of who I was and how I viewed the world. Can I tell you the first joke I ever wrote?
Sure. Yes, please.
It was, so the first joke we were taught to write was the joke structure was, I like my blank the way I like my blank.
Yes.
Blank. And my first joke I ever wrote, and no men think this is funny, which is like kind of my brand, is I like my uterus the way I like my calories empty.
Oh my gosh. I love
huh?
that.
Huh? I just am really proud of that joke.
That's a great joke.
And I don't think a man has ever laughed at it, which is, again, my whole... So you grew up nearby. I grew up in Burrage.
I grew up in Western Springs. We're like two towns over.
Yeah, exactly. And I just learned from a friend of mine, Alyssa, who's a big fan of yours, that you went to Bennett.
I did go to Bennett.
Which is like the Catholic school
it
in
is
the Chicago.
Extremely Catholic, yes.
Like the most Catholic. She wanted to tell you that whenever she drives by, she shakes her fist at it on your behalf. And also... And also, this is a quote, they're putting in a theater wing, but she doesn't know how they think they're going to do theater without the queers.
Wow. Yes.
So that's just a message from yes. Alyssa to you.
You know, I mean, first of all, I have a book coming out where I specifically name Bennett and talk about that time uh-huh. period in my life. And I just recorded the audiobook for it last week, and I realized how sort of nervous I am about that.
Yeah.
Even though I believe that my experience, like, I believe I'm telling the truth.
Yes.
I still feel, because high school there, I had a lot of teachers that were very nice to me. I had some friends that, you know, in some ways there were positive experiences, but also I think that there are some really damaging parts to having the type of Catholic upbringing that I had. And I,
yes.
anyway, I will say, I feel nervous to like call out that institution, also my college specifically.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not doing it to fuck anybody over, but to be specific.
Yeah.
And it's
your life. Like you have every right to own that part of your life.
I mean,
whole life.
I guess so, but I don't know.
Like, do you think the Pope's going to get mad at you for like shit talking?
I think it's, you know what? That's a, number one, that's a great question. I assume the Pope is already mad at me. But it's more so that I think it is always difficult to sort of like be the, you know, whistleblower
mm-hmm.
or whatever. That school seems to have worked for some people.
Yeah.
And so for me to be like, it didn't work for me.
Mm-hmm.
I think that is, you know, something that like, I just think as people like, the urging of our culture
uh-huh.
is to keep trauma private.
Yes.
And to keep negative experiences to ourselves
mm-hmm.
and to survive and move on.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think anytime that you're like, this actually was kind of fucked up.
Yeah.
That is a position that culture does not want to hear about.
Right, especially when it is institutionalized the way.
That's right.
Because whether or not you had a specific thing that happened to you, generally being a young closeted person in a Catholic school is inherently has to be traumatizing because you're being told that you are less than or worse than every day, just as part and parcel for showing up to school.
Yes. I mean, also, you know, being raised a woman in a very Catholic family and, you know, women can't be priests. Mm-hmm. Women can't. And then the hierarchy of priests, the cardinals or bishops or popes, mm-hmm. we don't have access to any of that. Mm-hmm. So we have actually no representation mm-hmm. anywhere mm-hmm. in the power structure of the church. Mm-hmm. Are there powerful women behind the scenes or like a random nun here and there, I'm sure, who like comes in and consults? Like, yes, I'm sure. Are we ever the ones writing the documents, signing the documents, giving the you know, speeches mm-hmm. or the homilies or
making
ever,
the smoke,
ever as the figurehead or on, you know, writ large or writ small?
Yeah.
No, we aren't. And I think that that also has a long-term damaging, in terms of self-esteem and value, that is not just, that's not just tied to queerness, mm-hmm. but literally, you know, 51% of the U.S. population are women. So I'm just going to like extrapolate from that 51% of Catholics are women, because why would that be a different ratio? Uh-huh. And so, you know, that number of people think that they're less than.
Mm-hmm. And it's, I mean, it all comes back to why representation matters. Because if you, as a young person, don't see yourself represented in any kind of powerful situation, you are going to deduce that you too have no power.
Right.
And that your opinion really doesn't matter because, you know, the smart men are taking care of it. Like, you just quiet your little head and let yeah. the boys take care of it.
I mean, it's also, it goes even beyond representation. It is explicitly stated mm-hmm. by the church
yeah.
that women are not worthy
yep.
of the priesthood, that are not worthy of being mm-hmm. heads of household and heads of churches.
Yeah.
And so, like, that is a lot to contend with.
But you were Catholic for a long time.
Yeah.
Like, through college, at least.
Through college.
How did you just sort of separate those two ideas in your mind, that you are a woman capable of making decisions and being smart and being on your own, but also this space is not welcoming of that?
No, I thought I wasn't capable of taking space Oof. And making decisions on my own. I will say I come from like a, you know, I had very supportive parents, and I also had like a very high level education. And I also come from a family of only sisters. So my parents were, you know, investing in us and pushing us uh-huh. and, you know, it's from like a very keeping up with the Joneses area of the mm-hmm. Chicago suburbs. So anyway, there was a lot expected mm-hmm. And that was happening. But at the same time, I did not actually think that I was equal to a man. Like, I really didn't. And I was a theology major in college. And when I was reading the documents, mm-hmm. That is like the literal documents from the church that say that women are not equal. That is the first time that I wondered about that. Because, mm-hmm. like, I read the actual words. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what it, like, why it was reading the actual words at that moment in my life. I think it was that that I had peers, male peers, who were, you know, theology majors, who then were speaking about this as if it was true. And also, I'm like, you're an idiot. Like, I know I'm an idiot.
Yeah.
Like, I'm 19. I know I'm 19.
Right.
Do you not know you're 19? Mm-hmm. Do you not know, like, we're both idiots? And then it made me realize, wait a minute, like, age doesn't actually matter. Like, is there so the older men in the church, mm-hmm. they have lived their entire life, they've met men, they've met women, and they think that men are better? Like, that, yeah. like, is this coming from a genuine place?
Yeah.
And I think that it started to sort of topple for me. I mean, I will say, I, like, never took a women's studies class, but it was as if I, like, sort of invented women's studies. Like, that, like, that's the very funny thing about, you know, feminism, or the things that, like, I now see were around the whole time. I felt like I was looking in the mirror being like, maybe women are equal and have been treated as if we are not biculture. Right. Like, I'm literally like that gif of like the numbers flying through the air around you while a woman's eyes are shifting back. Like, I just, yeah.
Well, and it's, so one of the common criticisms I get on this show, so normally we just do like a news-based kind of breakdown what's going on in the news as it relates to church and state issues, queer culture, feminism, things like that. And one of the criticisms we get fairly regularly is that we talk too much about, I talk too much about feminism or being a woman or sexism or women's rights. And to me, it's, and queer issues, to me, it's such an obvious one-to-one thing of, because of the sort of patriarchal teaching that we have, of course that's necessarily anti-feminist. And when men are making laws that restrict what we can or cannot do, of course that all comes from the same root of women aren't good enough to be priests. And it's wild to me that that is not a connection that's easier for people to make.
Mm.
And I don't... So can you talk a little... So I recently watched your latest stand-up special, the rape joke one, which was so good and necessary and great. Actually, can we talk a little bit about this sort of trend that's happening with comedy where it's more women feeling free to talk about their own sexual assaults, their own issues moving around this world with men, and how that links with comedy? Because inherently sexual assault isn't funny, but we've seen it in your set, in the Hannah Gatsby set, of kind of linking those two concepts together. And do you think it's just how women comedians process trauma or process what's happened to them?
I don't know. I mean, I don't, I will say that for me, right, so humor is a coping mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
And so, of course, it will be applied wherever there's trauma.
Right.
For the comic or for human, for, mm-hmm. For humans. And for me, our current president being elected did something, to my understanding of the world, that that made rape jokes a requirement for me just as an artist.
Uh-huh.
Because I feel like, I mean, well, first of all, clearly people have been elected for the entirety of the presidency who are openly racist,
right,
or who are openly sexist, mm-hmm. or who are openly homophobic.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is not...
It's almost a given.
I'm not, yeah, I'm not like a... Oh my God, is this the America that, like, it's like, yes, this is the America that we know.
Yeah.
But I think for me, what felt like so, what I felt surprised by was that he's a criminal.
Yes.
And we know he's a criminal. Like, we have actually heard his voice,
mm-hmm.
talking about assaulting women.
Right.
And I didn't feel like that had happened in my lifetime.
Yeah.
You know, like, I don't mean that we haven't had people doing dog whistling or even like being openly racist, but I mean, like,
they started saying the quiet part out loud.
Yes. And also the literal, you know, backstage microphone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, I know for a fact that there have been, you know, off-camera, yeah, conversations, or, you know, off-radio, mm-hmm. or off-pen, off-quill conversations for the entirety of the presidency. But it was just that we didn't have access to it the same way.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't feel, maybe there are people who are older who've seen different presidencies who had this experience. For
right.
me, you know, I'm 38. This was the first time I felt like we've literally heard his, like...
Him admit it.
We've heard
he says,
his criminal voice. Like, it's like he's even speaking in a different way. Uh-huh. Like, we've heard him say it.
Yeah. And it's not enough.
Enough. And it's also like his public face is also disgusting. Like, it's, you know, like, so disgusting and so out there.
Yeah.
And then to find, and then to, it's like, but he also has even more back,
yes,
backstage. And that it's that he's a criminal. He's a He's an actual...
like, he's a literal...
he's an actual violent criminal.
Which, it's so funny when watching, like, the impeachment proceedings and things like that happening, and the big Republican talking point was, well, they've been gunning for him since day one. It's like, well, yeah, he's been a criminal since day one. And he...
Yes.
What was your bit about bankrupting casinos, which is literally impossible?
Yes. Yes. So...
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, I think that is what made it's, I guess I felt the need to, look, I can't really do anything about, as people, I have limited power in the world, and that felt fucked up.
Yeah.
You know, to find that out again, because of course we find that out
over and over
again, but I just felt like, well, what I can do is I can talk in the first person about my perspective and my experience, and maybe this won't help anything, and I'm still going to do it.
Yeah, and I've talked about my own sexual assault on this show in for the same reason of, like, I need people to know that it's happening a lot and frequently and to people you know or have heard of or admire, and it's not a strange man in an alleyway attacking you. It is, you know, your boyfriend or, you know, your drinking buddy or whatever. Do you think, so to me, as sort of a comedy outsider, I felt like the podcasts I listened to, the content I was absorbing after 2016 took this, like, fundamental shift. And I'm wondering, as somebody on the inside, if you noticed that as well. Like, it felt like, you know, starting November 9th, 2016, like, comedy became, I don't know if heavier is the right word, but more meaningful or something. Was that just my perception, or did you notice that as well?
Well, you know, YouTube started in 2006. That's the same year that Twitter was born, and... then Obama's elected in 2008. So in terms of the internet and its effect on comedy, we have access to comedy that hasn't been passed through a zillion network, you know, executives that hasn't been. It's a more personal relationship because also podcasting is, you know, essentially hitting its stride in the early 2000s. Mm-hmm. So before that, everything that you're watching in terms of comedy is, like, something that's been approved by, you know, 87 suits, right? And so the stuff that gets on TV is that stuff. Mm-hmm. And then after YouTube, after Twitter, we're hearing from people more directly. Mm-hmm. And Obama's getting elected, and so the political situation seems to be moving in the direction of... you know, acknowledging our past as a country and it toward younger representatives, you know, like, as a president, he's like in shape. He's like, he
talks like us.
Yeah. You know, like, it's, and I,
or more like us.
Yeah. And he
talks like my cool professor.
And he's a black man. Uh-huh. And, you know, it just felt like, I think that comedy felt like surreal and goofy. Mm-hmm. And there was a lightness, and we don't really have a record of what comics felt like before that, because we were just telling jokes to audiences.
Yes.
And then, so this current presidency, I do think, has massively affected the tone of comedy, and comedy is sadder, heavier, and more burdened. Uh-huh. I mean, I don't know if you remember, like, what Twitter used to be, but, you know, for comics, it was, like, a way to kind of get hired for jobs. It was strictly joke writing. Mm-hmm. And now it is, like, strictly raising money for the fires in Australia.
Yeah.
Like, it is. And I think that is, I think it's a powerlessness. It's a feeling of powerlessness that before, I think folks, you know, maybe felt less of a burden to do something with their voice.
Yeah.
Just making people chuckle was enough.
Yeah. And it all of a sudden felt like we're kind of moving in the right direction, and then just, like, slammed back the other way in, like, this weird whiplash that we're all sort of still dealing with.
Right. I mean, comedy is inherently leftist and progressive because it is it is in conversation with, like, the old guard or conservatism. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it would be propaganda.
Right.
So, like, there are conservative comics or whatever, but those people are not in the... For me, I don't think they're in the like, spirit of what comedy actually does. Like, we are the jester making fun of the king.
Right. Right.
So if we are the jester that props up the king, mm-hmm. then, you know, we're... That's a different fucking dude.
Yeah. Yeah. So I actually really wanted to talk about this sort of inconsistency between how Hollywood et al. Is considered this, like, liberal bubble where people live. But really, when you're on the ground, most comedians, most decision makers, most actors, I don't know if most actors, but directors certainly are all straight white dudes. I'd like to just kind of that disconnect between, like, oh, everybody thinks that Hollywood's so liberal, but, like, we still don't have very good female representation in film or on TV. We have very little queer representation in film on TV without it being, like, the point of the show. It's like, haha, can't be gay guys, like, the show. I'm pitching that later today to NBC, can't be gay guy.
Yes.
So... As somebody who works in Hollywood, what is your...
I'm going to pour some water.
Okay, it's really
keep
good.
Going. Yes?
Wow. Seamless.
Yes.
as somebody who exists and works in Hollywood, do you find it's like this bastion of liberalism, or do you still see like echoes of the patriarchy in everything we do?
Well, you know, the thing that I think we don't talk about enough is that Hollywood, or like whatever word we want to use for that, the entertainment industry, mm-hmm. is an investment scheme. It is a way to make money.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what all of this is, mm-hmm. is that studios are essentially investors,
mm-hmm.
and they put money into certain properties,
mm-hmm.
hoping to get more money back. Mm-hmm. So it literally is the stock market.
Yeah.
Like, that is why a movie like Black Panther matters so much,
mm-hmm.
because they made a great return on their investment. Mm-hmm. And so therefore, okay, maybe a predominantly black cast
mm-hmm.
is valuable.
Yeah.
We're actually talking about value, meaning money.
Yeah.
And so I think that that's why... Even though, like, lip service might be given to diversity here in a different way. And the change is happening. I don't think the change isn't happening.
Mm-hmm.
It's still that, like, in the stock market, you play sure things, and then you have, like, a little bit of money to, like, mess around with.
Yeah.
So the sure thing is still the overrepresented straight white young
mm-hmm.
cisgender male viewpoint. Yeah. Like that's still the sure thing. I mean, I guess because women will watch that
mm-hmm.
and like,
cause we've been told we have to,
right.
That's so what entertainment looks
it's the
like.
Same reason that white women will like, you know, white women will show up and vote for the white male candidate. Mm-hmm. White women will watch the dude driven
mm-hmm.
show. And I think that we also assume that like people of color don't have money to spend. And so anyway, that's more of a gamble.
Mm-hmm.
I think that what's changing is the percentage of money that's going toward this, like,
mm-hmm.
I'm going to use like air quotes, like riskier properties, but that's what's happening. Yeah. Like it's, so really it's just, we're all trying to make money. Everybody's mm-hmm. trying to make money. The entertainment industry is an industry.
Mm-hmm.
And so I say this because, you know, for your listeners that would like to see, like, if you want to see different content, the best thing you can do is vote with your dollars.
Yeah.
So go see things in the theater or, you know, pay to subscribe to the streaming service that's showing the content that you want to watch
mm-hmm.
or, like, even, you know, watching clips of things on YouTube or, like, following the Twitter handle.
Mm-hmm.
Like, those things all matter because they prove to executives and also then executives answer to, like, conglomerates that are in, you know, Japan or China.
Right.
Like, I don't, this is all in the show 30 Rock or whatever, but like that GE is the boss of NBC, which is like the premise in that, like, that's all real.
Yeah.
There are like random businessmen elsewhere in the world just trying to watch and take care of their money.
Uh huh.
So, like, yeah, Jeff Bezos he's like, you know, delivering random shit to your door, but he's also spending money on programming.
Yeah.
It's the same guys making the decisions.
Is there any way out of, like, would, so Netflix famously doesn't, they don't usually release numbers, do they, in terms of, like, how many people
they
watch?
Don't release numbers.
So is that the solution, that you're not, we as an audience aren't necessarily tying one individual show or series or special to Netflix, which is like a money-making behemoth? Or just in terms of, if we want more representation, we need to make that prop, but it would Netflix be kind of separating, but I guess they have those numbers. Never mind.
They are watching, because they aren't releasing their numbers, mm-hmm. that is to protect their stock price. Because they don't want people to know when there's a fluctuation, mm-hmm. and they don't want to know how many viewers. They don't want people to know what is working, what isn't. They mm-hmm. don't want people to know when they have a flop. But they are tracking.
Yes,
like, they track
right.
the minute people stop watching something. I don't know if you know that. Like, mm-hmm. to the minute. Mm-hmm. And also, they know your demographic. So they know this demographic watched this movie until this minute. Mm-hmm. And that's not true just of Netflix. Those types of algorithms are being used by studios all over the place.
Sure.
So really, like, the best thing you can do is spend all of your disposable income, and that, like, however scalable that is to anybody,
yeah.
you know, on things that you want to watch. Because mm-hmm. it's also not just, like, what you believe in. It's like, I actually really love watching queer movies. Mm-hmm. So, like, I go see queer movies.
Yeah.
Because that's what I want to watch.
Yes.
So, again, just to, like, go back to that Stephen King point earlier, I'm not, like, going to see, like, lesbian movies because of... for charity's sake, it's because I love the hot, hot sex.
I, a couple of years ago when I saw Lady Bird, I realized, and like, I am a straight white woman from the Midwest. I saw Lady Bird and realized I had never seen a movie that was literally about me in that way. Cause it took place when I was in high school.
Right.
And it was like this weird theater dork, which I totally was, who was like dramatically singing Dave Matthews in the Car, also true. And I left the theater, I was like, holy shit, I've literally never seen a movie that was about like a kid who was in high school in the early 2000s. And it took me seeing Lady Bird to be like, oh, that doesn't exist literally anywhere. And I'm a millennial, like I'm a pretty big chunk of the population. And it's wild that we've just been like ignored because there was no value in our story, which is shitty.
Yeah, I mean, you know, also, so not placing value in the story also means that the people who could tell it maybe don't have the skill set. Mm-hmm. So again, this is what is actually really exciting, is that like Greta Gerwig does exist.
Yeah.
And is continuing to work with like the same group of actors, mm-hmm. and those people are getting attention. Again, this isn't necessarily always reflected in like the Academy Awards, but like Booksmart was a huge hit mm-hmm. this last year, or in 2019. And, you know, somebody like Ava DuVernay, she is, like, this is also how you like, fuck the system mm-hmm. in a really awesome way. She, like, invests her own money back
yeah.
in to creators that are Black or women or Black women.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, this is all very exciting
mm-hmm.
because it does mean that, like, part of the reason you also have not seen that story is because there was no one to tell it.
Yeah.
Or it was being told by like a dude from a distant
yes.
vantage point. And that's, you know, some of those things are really valuable and good, mm-hmm. but it's also really exciting that we're stepping into our own space.
Yeah.
So that is happening. I
yes.
want to like give you, you know, the hope that like it is really exciting too.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, I, yeah, you have to grab onto that sometimes because things look pretty bleak.
yeah.
So you were a guest a couple years ago on one of my favorite podcasts, My Brother and Me.
Oh, yeah.
And you said something that has stuck with me ever since about people in this spotlight have a responsibility to come out if they are gay. Do you still think that? And can you kind of speak to that a little bit? Or do you remember saying that?
I don't remember saying that. It does sound like me. what's up to the McElroy brothers? Yeah, you know, I do actually believe that. I do believe that,
mm-hmm.
especially if there are, I think there are a couple factors here. I think like emotional safety, which can sometimes have to do with financial freedom or age.
Mm-hmm.
I think those things are really important. So mm-hmm. I would never advocate that somebody who is not in a
right.
safe
of
situation
course.
put themselves
right.
through the process of coming out. And I do think it's important to say that, because I think, you know, even something like National Coming Out Day will be on Twitter, and it's like, there's this like get yourself out there, get yourself out there. But if you are, you know, having private conversations at home, if you are having sex, if you are partnered to someone, and you have financial stability and, you know, career success and independence. Yeah, I think it's a, bummer, you know, I do actually think it's a bummer. I think that it, well, first of all, I think that the number one person that that will benefit is not like the community at large, but the individual.
Right.
Who's in the closet. And I like would want that for them. But I also think that, you know, being honest about how many queer folks there are. I mean, it's literally like, I'm going to draw an analogy to like Prince Harry and Meghan Markle. Like, we don't have to fucking do this anymore.
Yes.
I felt I do not know these people at all. I am not a royal watcher. I felt so proud of them for the boundaries that they were able to draw. I felt so inspired by this. This is why I think that it is important. Because to draw boundaries and, like, this is my life that I am living.
Yeah.
That is inspiring to see.
Right. I'm a freelance writer, but I had to go to an office for an onboarding thing. And it was, like, right when that whole thing got announced. And literally all anybody was doing was talking about it and how, like, oh, she's just trying to have her cake and eat it, too. And I was like, what the fuck? Like,
wait, you went somewhere where people had a negative impression of this?
Can you believe it?
I actually...
Wait, seriously? Have you only heard positive things?
Yes.
Bless your sweetheart. Like,
I do live in Los Angeles. I'm looking at Jordan, who's recording this for us. Please tell me the negative things. I actually don't know. I mean, of course I know the negative things of, like, what the queen would say, you know, or whatever. Like, I can imagine what the queen would say.
No, it's...
Those people in Aurora are saying about this.
It was in Chicago. No big deal.
Tell me about tell me about that loop opinion.
It was that she said, like, this one particular woman who was talking a lot about it to every different person
sitting around me. I'm just curious.
My age.
Your age. Okay. This, like, is a white person?
A white person, woman, maybe early 30s, working in a big, in the marketing department of a very big consulting company.
Do you happen to know if she's married?
Unclear.
Unclear. Great. Okay. Let's keep going.
But she was just like, she seems to think that Meghan Markle is like trying to get away with something, of that she wants the money and the security that comes with marrying into the royal family without the, and big air quotes, responsibility, whatever the fuck those are, which.
Okay.
And I've seen that. I have a family member who is like big royal watcher, and she is like hashtag disappointed about it. It's just such a,
what?
I know.
I feel very grateful that you're giving me a little bit of an op-ed about how this could be negative.
And but even like I'm listening.
So this sounds like these women are straight up jealous.
I mean,
which is very funny. So. It's like from a position of like, I wouldn't behave this way given the crown or whatever, which is very funny.
Which is bizarre because I just recently saw a tweet that put tweets about Kate was the other sister. The one married to the brother.
Kate Middleton.
Kate Middleton and Meghan about like headlines about them right next to each other.
Right.
And the way Meghan Markle has been treated by the press is horrifying.
Yes.
Horrifying. And that was another thing that this girl kept saying. She's like, you know, Kate hates her now. And I was like, probably not. I bet she's fucking miserable too, but she just decided to roll with it. But it would be like, you know, look at Kate and her voluptuous baby bump. And then the headline for Meghan Markle would be like, why can't Meghan Markle stop touching her tummy? Like, just.
Yeah, I mean, right. So a colonial empire still has a racism.
Yeah, can you believe it?
Built into its media. I absolutely was aware of the way that she has been treated, and I felt like we all were. But I also felt like to me, it just spoke to this idea of how much we all have responsibility uh-huh. in the world.
Yeah.
Sometimes responsibility that's even chosen mm-hmm. or responsibility that comes with a lot of benefits.
Yeah.
I mean, I get to do a job that I really love, and very few people get that choice. Mm-hmm. And also at the same time, it is okay to draw boundaries and have the life that I want. And so it makes me like a little sad thinking about those women that you're talking about, or anybody that might feel that yeah. way in terms of somebody shirking her responsibility. I kind of want to ask them some follow-up questions about how they draw boundaries in their own life.
Oh, I was keeping my head down. I did not want to talk to these
people. Yeah, I'll do it for you.
Okay, thank
I don't
you.
Want I don't expect you I feel that you it sounds like you really got through this work event.
Yeah.
And I really feel proud of you.
Thank you so much.
But I just
much.
Mean
I'm very
me
brave.
As somebody who doesn't have any
skin in the game
just to be able to walk in and be like, now tell me how often you see your family of origin versus how much you'd like to see them.
Yeah.
Is it the same amount?
Yeah.
Like, do you feel burdened by other people's expectations?
Imagine living with your mother-in-law, your grandmother-in-law.
It's yeah.
No, I don't. That's too much. It's simply too much. Also, you know, it's the other thing, and I did not intend for this to be a Royals-themed show.
Sounds like it is, though.
And here we are. It's literally the plot of a romance novel, is that
yes.
a prince falls in love with a commoner and leaves it all behind to be... It's like the plot of Red, White... Have you read Red, White, and Royal Blue?
I have read it.
Did you love it as much as I have?
I thought it was great, and I'm going to interview the author for my own podcast.
Really? Can you tell her I loved it?
Yes, definitely.
I've read it three times.
Yeah.
What? Why?
Yeah.
Things are bleak. I just wanted to, like, dig into this, like, happy little book. I've talked about it so much on the podcast, I get tweets, like, once a day of someone being like, Jess, I finally read Red, White, and Royal Blue. It's...
Yeah.
Anyway, what is happening is if we saw a movie, we'd be like, what a wonderful happy ending
I
of
know.
That they got to be together without the scrutiny of the queen or whatever they're doing.
Like, yeah, it's also the plot of multiple Disney movies, which I wonder if, like, I wonder, I mean, especially
what
like,
is happening?
Especially more recent Disney movies, like if we think about sort of starting maybe even at like, okay, I don't know if you saw the remake. I don't know if you saw the live-action Aladdin, but it's very funny. I saw it on a plane. great plane viewing. It's very funny because they, like, switched some things around
okay.
just a little bit uh-huh. so that Jasmine actually has political power and also that she, like, decides to be, like, a queen in terms of, like, as a political post,
uh-huh.
which is very funny compared to their animated.
Yeah.
But anyway, I just wonder, like, this person who's having this big problem,
uh-huh.
I wonder how they felt about the movie, like, Moana, for instance, or, like, Frozen, or, I just feel like you're right. This narrative of, like, a woman coming
yeah.
into her own power and deciding that she is who she wants.
Right.
And what part of the responsibility that she feels to her family that she's going to live up to
uh-huh.
versus how she's going to follow her own dreams. That is the plot of...
Every movie!
It's also the plot of, like, Girls. It's also
yeah.
the plot of... It's the plot of everything. It is the plot for women.
I feel like I'm having that gif again of the numbers
yeah.
like flying by
yeah.
my face. Like, how did that happen? That is absolutely wild. That is weird, wild shit.
Yeah.
I am probably taking up too much of your time, but I really think this is the part of the podcast where I just ask you to tell cool anecdotes. You know,
okay, great.
Like a real chill
yes, let's
person
do it.
Does.
we might end on this.
Okay,
so
that's fine.
If that is okay.
This is it. Could you quickly relate the story of how you first kissed a woman and then got ringworm?
Oh, sure, yeah. Well, I was, I was really involved in social justice work in college, which meant I went on solidarity trips. More information about this in my forthcoming book, Save Yourself, which is available March 24th.
Nice
so you
book.
Could, like, really...
I'm going to put it in the...
hear this...
episode notes.
Yes, people should buy it.
What's it called?
It's called Save Yourself.
Save Yourself.
And it absolutely deals with faith and feminism and it's very funny. But yeah, I was in Kingston, Jamaica and came back from a trip to Kingston, Jamaica, kissed a woman for the first time and then the morning after woke up with... raised red bumps on my face, which I later found out was facial ringworm. very contagious. And also a really shocking thing, if you've ever seen the movie The Exorcist and you're raised very Catholic, is to wake up with letters, like it was like a full O.
And what did you think it's?
Yes, for ovaries.
For ovaries.
Yeah, on my face and... I had also kissed some men the night before, so I had to call 3 different people and explain to all of them that I had a very contagious facial fungus.
Slash demonic possession.
Slash demonic possession.
Possibly.
Possibly.
Which is also contagious.
It is. Through the mouth. You know how demons travel. So yeah, anyway, that full story is in this book. That's... And your listeners should read it.
Yeah, they absolutely should. Just really quick before you go, do you think that your existence as a podcaster, so a lot of the experience I have is when people write in saying, oh, I'm from this tiny town in nowhere, I'm the only atheist I know. What is it about hearing your own story that makes you feel better? Like when, I'm sure you get a lot of feedback from that of gay people in the middle of nowhere who don't feel like they can come out. Is it knowing you're not alone and that's what they need at that moment, do you think?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I also think, right, the basis of humor is relatability.
Uh-huh.
So even if we haven't all had the same experiences, mm-hmm. the thing that we're actually relating to each other on is the emotion that we have. So like earlier you were saying, you know, you were comparing your uterus and...
calories.
Calories.
It's emptiness. A great joke.
Great joke.
Thank you.
So like those two things and the feeling of, and that the fact that they provide an emptiness, that they are empty, that comparison, like that's what people can relate to mm-hmm. and not necessarily the lived experience. And anyway, I think we're always looking for that, is how to relate to each other. Mm-hmm. That's literally why religion exists. Mm-hmm. We're just on this planet. We're born and we just spend the rest of our time until we die trying to relate to each other.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I think that's why podcasting is also so effective, because you're literally in somebody's ears with them.
Yeah.
It's like almost the closest you could be.
It feels very intimate.
Very
intimate. And you feel like you know a person.
Yeah. So yeah, we're all just trying to relate to each other.
Yeah. I love that. I think that's a great note to end on. So anything you want to plug that my listeners might be interested in?
Yeah, my podcast is called Query, and I do long-form interviews with folks in the LGBTQ+ community. It is serious and dramatic, and it is funny, and it is sweet. And anyway, I really love doing it, and folks should listen. I've had some great guests, like really, really great guests. And then also, yeah, my book is called Save Yourself, and... You could pre-order it now, no matter when this comes out.
Mm-hmm.
And thank you so much for the conversation.
Thank you very much. And yeah. We'll talk to you guys soon.